Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This hour is brought to you by the law offices of Jeffrey M. Leving.
Mike Florio.
Let's bring in Mike Florio here. Joins us on the program.
NBC Sports.
All right, Florio, I know you're probably busy.
Pro Football Talk.
Starts the day, he ends the day with Pro Football Talk. He is Mike Florio.
Within moments, a long national nightmare is apparently coming to an end.
I don't know what you're talking about. You can't trust a quarterback who can't stay healthy.
I wouldn't listen to some of those people out there, especially guys like Mike Florio.
Go to hell with your big brain. Ladies and gentlemen, Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio.
Mike Florio with Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi.
How are you, Mike?
On the Score.
Mike Florio's on Twitter, at Pro Football Talk. He is on the Alpamonte Nissan Hotline. Alpamonte Nissan on North Avenue in Melrose Park, or at apnissan.com. Mike, how are you?
Good. How are you today?
We're good, and we're just keeping an eye on every next little bit of information in the Aaron Rodgers saga, just because of the impact that that has on the Bears, on the NFC North, on the rest of the league. And the latest chapter has him apparently comparing general manager Brian Gutekunst to Jerry Krause, which is never a good thing, as we know.
Well, no, that is definitely not a good thing. This is such a strange situation to me, but I believe at the end of the day it was all orchestrated, calculated, and strategically implemented by Rodgers and his camp. A week ago today, the seeds were planted. I think they got to the 49ers and cajoled the 49ers into believing there was reason to call the Packers about a possible trade. Then that got leaked the next day, conveniently, by Rodgers' camp. And then it snowballed from there. I think Rodgers, and this is like Godfather Game of Thrones type stuff, Rodgers decided he was going to exact his revenge on the first day of the draft. The first draft after, they made this problem what it is by trading up to get Jordan Love. And we're 6 days into it now. There's been no indication from Rodgers that all of this is anything but 100% truthful. And I think he still may try to do the Steve Urkel thing and act like it's all overblown and it's no big deal, but I think it's too late for that. He wants out, and I think his people got the word out, and that's just part of this effort to create chaos for the Green Bay Packers until they give him what he wants.
Well, we're even seeing news drop this morning. Bob McGinn reporting in The Athletic that the Packers have offered to make Rodgers the highest-paid quarterback, but they were rejected. Again, this is just a report. And then supposedly Rodgers is mocking Gutekunst to his teammates, calling him Jerry Krause. So I guess we at least know he's a Chicago Bulls fan if you watch The Last Dance.
Well, you know, the thing about McGinn and his report, I've heard that Rodgers wanted to be the highest paid quarterback in the NFL. And that would require more than $45 million per year in new money. That's what Patrick Mahomes got. Now, what you average on a deal over the life of it versus what you actually have guaranteed, and more importantly, how committed the team is to you. You could put a ridiculous balloon salary on the back end that's fake and it's phony and it drives up the average. There are some rules about how far it can go up in any one year. But my point is, you can create a contract that, if every check is cashed, makes you the highest paid quarterback in football in retrospect. But the question is, what does it do by way of giving up the team's ability to rip the contract up? And I think that's the core of this problem. Once they added Jordan Love and Aaron Rodgers moved into the year-at-a-time phase of his contract, the Packers had a situation where they could assess it 1 year at a time. And after 2020, do we go to Jordan Love or do we stick with Aaron Rodgers. Well, he was the MVP. We're sticking with Aaron Rodgers. After 2021, what are we going to do? After 2022, what are we going to do? And Rodgers is trying to short-circuit that process because he doesn't like this hanging over his head. So whatever the and look, maybe they made the offer too little too late to get his attention. He may have already decided, forget it, I've given you a chance to fix this and I want out. Regardless, that's kind of where we are. They've gone out to see him at least three times. It hasn't solved the problem. The problem's clearly there, and now the question becomes whether the Packers trade him or whether they just say, go ahead and sit. And, you know, that's a philosophical question that I've been trying to pose to Packers fans generally. Would you rather get value for him and have him play for another NFL team or just have him walk away and never play again?
Well, if I'm a fan, I think it's easy. You want some kind of fair compensation. I mean, you definitely would want your I don't know how you could not want your team to have to have assets.
Well, what if the Patriots had traded Tom Brady to the Buccaneers, and in hindsight, you'd ask a Patriots fan, would you have rather not gotten whatever you got from the Buccaneers and not have to watch the Buccaneers win the Super Bowl? I mean, I think that's the thing that would gall Packers fans. And, you know, when a great quarterback leaves a team, I think that team would probably prefer he never play again. And think about the structure in Green Bay. There's no owner. So Mark Murphy, the CEO of the team, potentially is going to be held accountable at some point for how he handles this. From his perspective, the best way to handle it would be for Favre to retire, repay and or forfeit a total of $44.5 million, which would give the Packers cap space, flexibility, etc. And you're never proven wrong. If he never plays again, you're never proven wrong. You never got those draft picks, so you never know what those draft picks could have been. And Favre never plays for someone else and wins a Super Bowl or beats you in a Super Bowl or plays in another conference for a year or two and then comes back and becomes the quarterback of the Vikings. So, you know, Murphy lived through this the last time, and it didn't bring him down. But I just think that from the standpoint of the way that corporation works, if you're upper management with the Packers, I think maybe you'd just rather have the $44.5 million.
It's almost a, if I can't have him, nobody else can type of attitude.
Well, yeah, and that's, remember when Peyton Manning was about to be cut or had been cut by the Colts in 2012 and they were getting ready to draft Andrew Luck, Rob Lowe had one iteration as an NFL reporter, and he tweeted with information that everyone believes he got from his friend Jim Irsay, the owner of the team, that Peyton Manning was going to retire. That was a manifestation of Jim Irsay's wishful thinking, because the last thing Irsay wanted was Peyton Manning to play somewhere else. Now, different context, they didn't trade Peyton Manning, but yeah, you don't want that great quarterback who maybe didn't do as much with you as you had hoped, and the Packers have one Super Bowl win to show for their time with Aaron Rodgers. You don't want him matching that with another team, or God forbid, exceeding that with another team. And I think that complicates Mark Murphy's future with the team. And I don't know how much longer he plans to be the CEO, but that definitely complicates his future if he ends up going to Denver this year and the Broncos suddenly become an elite team and win a Super Bowl. And it would be high drama, and it would drive the ratings through the roof if they would play the Packers in the Super Bowl, but you just don't want that. You'd rather him not play. So whatever draft picks I get balanced against the $44.5 million I'd receive, I don't know, what are those draft picks worth? I mean, that's part of it. That really has to be part of it. I can have $44.5 million if he never plays again for anyone, or I can let him play for someone else. I save $14 million in salary, and I get draft picks. So it's really down to a net of about $30 million. What do I need in draft picks to offset the fact that if he just is stubborn and retires, we keep $30 million?
Mike, we're nearly a week removed already from the first round of the NFL draft, and I always enjoy now what happens in this interim period when we start getting the reports from how draft rooms really worked for how, say, the Bears ended up moving on Justin on the trade that brought them Justin Fields. We get these little mini oral histories as information filters into the news bloodstream a little bit. And what are you learning? What conclusions are you drawing about how this went down, about some of the uncertainties this year, about the continued weirdness of the Las Vegas Raiders, how they just have a way of looking at football that seems different from others? That what do we know more now about some of these groups that run these rooms?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Raiders, because I do not believe that John Gruden has been available to speak anywhere, any place, to anyone since the draft or during the draft. It was all Mike Mayock, the GM of the team. There's reason to believe that there's some sort of dysfunction between Gruden and Mayock. Some thought that maybe Mayock would have been made a scapegoat after the 2020 season, just like Paul Gunther, the defensive coordinator, was run out the door with a few weeks left in the season, that Mayock was in danger. The problem, though, is if you're Gruden and you run the show, it becomes difficult to get an adequate replacement on the fly for your general manager. But there's reason to believe there's something there. And it could be that Gruden is just trying to insulate himself completely from the draft picks, even though he's involved. It looks like it's someone else to set the stage for making a change next year if that's what they decide to do. So that one's very interesting. The other thing that I just love, the very real moment between Howie Roseman and Tom Donahoe with the Eagles after they traded down a few spots in round three. Yeah. They lost out on a guy that Donahoe wanted them to get because of it, and Howie does the fist bump, and Donahoe has the reaction, and Howie reacts to that. And then Donahoe tells Chris Mortensen that, you know, it's just silly. I didn't even know the cameras were on. Well, yeah, that gave us a real moment. Reality TV isn't real when everybody thinks the cameras are on. You only get reality when people don't know the cameras are on. And I just thought that part of it was fascinating. And everyone in these draft rooms needs to assume that if you're in that room, anything you say, anything you do is being caught on camera.
I had a very good laugh with some Eagles fan friends at that video, Mike. We have a report that the Broncos are bringing in free agent tackles for visits. Supposedly, they have not talked to Charles Leno yet. What's the likelihood that they do now that he's no longer going to be a Bear?
Well, I think they're going to have to look at everyone who's available. This is the kind of thing that if it had happened last week, they could have drafted a replacement for Juwan James, who suffered an Achilles tendon tear while working out on his own. They could have gotten Alejandro Villanueva, who signed with the Ravens just yesterday, and the Ravens like to work the free agency angles to the point where they don't have that acquisition count toward compensatory draft picks. They wait until that window closes before they sign certain guys. If it had happened one day sooner that Juwan James suffers that injury, the Broncos would have been in the mix for Villanueva, because his former position coach in Pittsburgh, Mike Munchak, is the offensive line coach in Denver. And on that issue of the players staying away from workouts, I really get the impression that they don't understand, and hopefully they will understand and they will learn through this Juwan James example, that it makes plenty of financial sense to show up and work out at the team facility. It is free insurance that protects your salary. It protects other elements of compensation if you suffer that freak injury there. If it happens anywhere else, you have a major, major problem. For Juwan James, it's about $18 million that he's going to potentially lose all told. He's going to have to pay back some money that he already received if the Broncos want to play hardball, and teams are going to be inclined to play hardball because you got the union urging these guys to not show up. There is a real financial risk for every player who doesn't show up, and Juwan James, an extreme example, but hopefully it gets these other players to realize that they need to think this through, and they need to make a strategic decision about whether they're going to stay away, because it really hurt James. And I think if James understood all the ramifications, he probably wouldn't have stayed away.
You know, we talk about the difference in opinion when it comes to assessing draft picks. One thing that is somehow kind of satisfying about the NFL business is every year someone's trash is someone else's treasure. And Layla brought up Charles Leno, and Bears fans were just sick of Charles Leno. It's like, you know, the I would say familiarity breeds contempt, and you start to like, oh, this Leno guy, because you watch him every week, and you magnify the bad. You say, well, there was a holding penalty, or there was an offsides, and somebody else says, hey, that guy was a 7-year starter at left tackle that went to a Pro Bowl, and Bears fans do it too. They'll say, who's this new guy from another team? I remember seeing him, and the cycle repeats itself. You can call it out of town stupid or whatever you want to say, but this league does a good job of recycling guys into useful parts.
Well, it's the hope that comes from uncertainty, because that guy who, for whatever reason, struggled elsewhere, it's all going to fall together for him here. We have a plan. We're going to get him to become something he hasn't been. And coaches think that, whether it's a player who has struggled elsewhere on the field, players who struggle off the field, every coach thinks he's the coach who's going to get through to that guy who's been a problem, and all of a sudden he's going to become a Pro Bowler. But, yeah, hey, look, there's needs that every team will have, and there's a finite way to go about addressing them, especially after free agency and the draft. There aren't many guys available. So all of a sudden, a guy looks pretty darn interesting. But if he was that attractive, you find a trade partner for him. And, guys get cut for a reason, and it's because the phone calls were made for a possible trade, and the reaction was, no, thank you.
Similarly, on that topic, somewhat, there was an article that came out on Pro Football Talk talking about Matt Rhule's faith in Sam Darnold. What does he see in him, and what is the faith that he has in his production?
Well, and it's hard to really know what the ceiling is for Sam Darnold based on 3 years with the Jets. And the NFL has changed so dramatically. I've said time and again that if the standards that apply to quarterbacks now would apply to Terry Bradshaw, he'd have been working at a gas station in Shreveport when the immaculate reception happened. It would have been Terry Hanratty or Joe Gillum that threw that pass. So that's just the way the NFL is now. And you get run out of town quickly when the team concludes after 1, 2, 3 years, usually it's 2 or 3, that you're not going to be a franchise guy. And, oh, look, we have a shot at a franchise guy. So the Panthers, I think, are willing, just like they were last year. They loved Teddy Bridgewater last year. And then after 1 year, they fell out of love with him. And I think Sam Darnold needs to realize that the same thing can happen to him. But they see a guy who can come in, run the offense, improve within the system that Joe Brady runs. You've got Christian McCaffrey. You've got receivers better than what Sam Darnold ever had at his disposal in New York, and they have plenty of faith. But there still was a vague sense that they were taking a close look at the available quarterbacks. And some were surprised they passed on Mac Jones and Justin Fields. But, you know, they're at least going to go with Darnold for this year. But if Darnold doesn't meet whatever level they're looking for, David Tepper, the owner of that team, is desperate to get a franchise quarterback, and he's willing to give Darnold a test drive. And he will conclude, after 1 year, yes or no, up or down, and if it's down, they'll move on from Sam Darnold.
You're so right, Mike, about the standards for quarterbacking. And if you look at some of these Hall of Famers and some of the all-time greats at the position, and you look at the overall numbers, like, you know, I always bring up Joe Namath, and the way people just now, the premium on efficiency has just trumped everything on completion percentage and touchdown to interception ratio. Weird way of asking, is it good for the game? Do you think that football is better when quarterbacks aren't allowed any time to be bad in their development, when they're not allowed to take risks? What makes for a better game?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because teams, some of them, would be better off giving that quarterback 4 or 5 years to figure out the game and reach his full potential. We'll see, because guys are going to get pushed out sooner than ever because the young quarterbacks are coming in and they're playing better than ever. That's why the Jets didn't give Sam Darnold more time. They had a chance to get Zach Wilson. And if Darnold goes somewhere and has kind of a Vinny Testaverde second act, all of a sudden the guy's pretty good, that may get teams to think twice before they pull the plug. So I think it depends on what happens as these quarterbacks get run out. Was the assessment right after 3 years with Sam Darnold that he's not going to be a franchise guy? But the fact that teams are willing to embrace young players, put them on the field, accommodate their offenses to fit their strengths, and we're seeing more and more young quarterbacks turn out to be on the pass side of the pass fail line, I think that's going to result in more quarterbacks being drafted, more quarterbacks being held to a higher standard. and more quarterbacks being traded to teams like the Panthers or whoever is looking for a new quarterback at any given moment.
Mike, appreciate it as always. I look forward to talking next week.
All right, great talking to you. See you.
Thanks,
Mike. That is Mike Florio, who joins us weekly to talk NFL. We had a crackling pitching performance in Cincinnati last night by a young White Sox hurler who I bet you didn't know actually made baseball history with what he did last night. It was a very, very special night for Dylan Cease, and I will tell you specifically what historical achievement it was when we come back and talk a little White Sox next, and Bernstein and Rahimi on the Score.
Mully and Hall, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports morning show, period.
Rich is in Lakeview. Hey, Rich.
Morning, Rich.
Hey, Mully. Hey, Hall. I just want to say I love listening to you guys. I used to listen to the other side of town. And then thank God for the producer over there who hooked you guys up, because this is the most educated, smoothest, comedic show with no hot takes in the city. And I really enjoy listening to you fellas, number one.
Mully and Hall, mornings 5 to 9 a.m. on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago's sports station and Odyssey station. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago's sports station.
That's my stat.
That's a tall guy to strike out at the top of the strike zone, and Dylan Cease now has 8 strikeouts, 1 hit, 3 walks, 2 times through the order. 2-2. Struck him out, planted on the inside corner. Breaking ball, and he nailed it. Little kick on the flourish for Dylan Cease. Strikeout number 10. Strike 3, changeup for Dylan Cease. And this is mastery from the Sox young right-hander. 11 strikeouts, ties a career high.
That was NBC Sports Chicago, an interesting combo of two play-by-play guys who were taking turns calling the game and commenting on the game, and Lynn Casper and Jason Benetti. And I texted both of them during the game. I said, this is completely indistinguishable from my White Sox fan group chat right now. And I meant it as a compliment. It just sounded like people I know talking about a White Sox game. I thought it was awesome. I hope everybody enjoyed it as much as I did.
We also are blessed with announcers who are not just wonderful at their jobs, but also have great senses of humor. And I feel like that was definitely on display yesterday, whether it's Boog joking with Chafin about his mustache or what we saw last night with Benetti and Len. It was like the two most eloquent and smooth fans, you know, talking about the White Sox in that game last night. But it was a pleasure, to say the absolute least, to see those two pair up together.
Yeah, there's a comfort level to it. And it's weird for me because, you know, when you know people personally, it just sort of it's almost odd in that way to sort of have, you know, all of these, the familiarity of these voices, who the people we talk to all the time, also describing the baseball that we're watching. And then on the other, when I first heard Rick Sutcliffe's voice, I wasn't prepared for it. And there was something going on with the audio mix, I think, that made him sound more cartoony than usual. And they fixed it. But it was something weird in the mix where I don't know how they engineered it. I would have to talk to a Dave Miska or a Paul Zerang about how this works. But he was like, he sounded like Chumley for a while. And then they kind of trimmed it down, and they did something to make him sound more human. But that's not why you called. I mentioned that Dylan Cease made history. He is, according to Stats by Stats on Twitter, Dylan Cease of the Chicago White Sox is only the second pitcher in the modern era to strike out 10 or more, allow no more than one hit, and also have 3 or more hits at the plate in a game. The other was Catfish Hunter in his perfect game on May 8th of 1968.
Cool.
Yeah, right?
I'm just going to refer to this game as the Dylan Cease game.
Because, and obviously game score for a pitcher doesn't measure the fact that you also had 3 hits. And like legit hits, too. Those weren't like, you know, little bleeders or bloopers. Like that was he came up there to swing the bat. And a moving bat is a dangerous bat, right?
Well, when you can make some contact, which he did. But we're going to focus on the three hits by the pitcher, and it's going to be a happy little place, and we can have fun with it. And Mully jokingly referred to Dylan as Shohei Ohtani in a way. But that's not the big deal to me. It's like the fun piece of it. It's the icing on a cake where you have more icing than is normal and you love it, but it still has to have some structure. And the structure was absolutely what we saw out of Dylan Cease. I am so encouraged by his last two starts. And he had a conversation with Lance Lynn that I think is deserving of some discussion. Because for all the exaltation we're giving Ethan Katz, let's also give credit to when you have good pitchers on a staff and you have veterans on a staff, a lot of the instruction that goes on is just a simple talking shop between two pitchers. I was reminded of Reynaldo Lopez when he really looked up to Ivan Nova and how that helped him before he ended being cut from the team. But it happened with Lance Lynn. And the quote is, he basically just asked me what I was focusing on, as in Lynn asked Cease. And I told him about how my body was moving and all these things that didn't matter. He said that he had been there before, but to really lock in on where my target is and how I'm trying to shape the pitches. And it was really that simple. The Reds have the second best offense in all of baseball. And he shut it down.
Yeah, and he looked in control. He looked like he knew, after he saw a swing, he had every idea of what the plan was to attack that swing path. And that's a really satisfying watch. And when you have a guy, you know, popping the mitt at some of those velocities and having guys start to guess a little bit, it maybe having the run cushion helps him as well. You can never really measure the psychological effect of that. But that was a very satisfying game to watch, especially for White Sox fans who are already sort of on tenterhooks regarding what the future holds after these injuries.
Absolutely. He was the wild card. Dylan Cease was the wild card for the Sox in the starting rotation. And even less than a week ago, he couldn't manage to go five innings in a start this year. And that echoed what we saw out of him the year before. But he threw that complete game shutout in the seven-inning doubleheader against Detroit. That was encouraging, but it's Detroit. Your test is going to be being in Cincinnati. I thought we were going to see the pitchers duel today because it's Dallas Keuchel and Sonny Gray. But I was wrong. Dylan Cease provided the pitching performance that I didn't think anybody was going to get in Cincinnati. And to break it down simply, to have that matching career high 11 strikeouts, that's the guy you thought he was going to be. The three hits are cute. They're nice. They're fun. But that's not why you're here. You're here to watch him do what he did on the mound.
No, but it did have me looking up Catfish Hunter's perfect game, which is always fun to do, to have an excuse to go back and educate oneself about that. And it was 13 months or a little over 13 months before my earthly existence began. But what's interesting also about that game, it was only the ninth, at that point, only the ninth perfect game ever in Major League Baseball. And only 6,298 fans were there, which is the smallest attendance to watch any MLB perfect game. That's a small crowd, boy. 6,298 at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. Nothing better to do in Oakland? I mean, really?
Listen, the Oakland A's have been getting knocked for their capacity at their stadium and whether or not they can fill it for many years. Shockingly, it's not just the Sox who get made fun of for that. It's definitely other teams, too.
No, and I understand you didn't have Twitter then to maybe spread the word and say, hey, you know, you can go grab a ticket and go hang out and maybe watch a perfect game. Hall of Famer Catfish Hunter.
Information did not travel that quickly. Also, I totally thought that you were going to go on a discussion about how perfect games meant more then, because now pitching is what it is and you want to devalue the no-hitter.
Well, no, that was 68. No, remember, that was 68. That was the pitching year. That was the year where pre-expansion, then remember they lowered the mound? That was when Gibson had his 1-1-2 or whatever it was. And the leading hitter was batting .301. That was the year. Denny McClain, you know, 68 was where people said, holy crap, the pitching's too good. Although we should bring up the point that Joe Sheehan has made, that moving the mound didn't really do anything. That it came out in the wash within a couple years. And Sheehan's point is you really want to solve the issue of dominant pitching, expand. He said that's what really levels it. That's what makes the difference, is when other major league teams have to fill out pitching staffs and you water down the quality of pitching overall on each roster. And that if you really looked at what happened to the numbers, it kind of normalized that this whole thing about raising the mound, lowering the mound, it didn't really end up having the effect that many people think it did when you factor in other things, which I found really interesting historically.
That is. And it just makes sense from a simple number standpoint. You're weakening the sample size.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that. If you are a Sox fan and you've wanted to see Dylan Cease do Dylan Cease things, that was a performance to hang your hat on, period. And to do it against that Reds offense, which has been outstanding, that's very significant.
It is. And to sustain something where you got a piece of advice from a teammate, and like you say, it happens organically, and these guys spend time with each other when they can actually be, and they're over the 85% threshold, the White Sox, which is important here because the Cubs are not, and it allows them to have loosened restrictions on intermingling, and maybe something like this becomes more likely to happen, where somebody gets a thought in their head that just unlocks something, because baseball's weird. You know, golf is like that too. And sometimes somebody gives you a tip that just makes you better at what you do. And it happened last year when James McCann and Lucas Giolito recognized, you know what? We were working faster because the rain was coming and we pitched better because we were working faster and we happened onto something. And sometimes when you have teams able to spend more time around each other, maybe you increase the likelihood of some of those lights going on.
Two things. I would hope in a sport where people voluntarily shower together that they would feel comfortable talking shop, and that as long as you recognize what is making your process good, whether it's in work that isn't baseball or what have you, and you're able to identify the success point, then you're probably going to replicate that success later.
Do they the showers have stalls, though? They don't still, like, voluntarily go into, like, a big, like, prison shower room with no dividers, do they?
How am I supposed to know?
Well, it's been a long time since I've been in a locker room. My guess is they're not all sort of showering in mass like we used to at camp, where it was like a big room with just shower heads in the wall, and you kind of stood there.
I don't care. It's still the same idea. There's a room and you're all together and you do it on a regular basis. You should be able to talk shop. And I can confirm 100% that I would have no idea.
Well, baseball players also shower all the time. Like, they hit and they go in from hit or warm-ups and they shower, and then they get their uniform on and then they play and then they shower. A lot of these guys, it's like a 4 times a day thing where I don't think I would shower after batting practice. It just seems weird to me, but that's sort of the baseball tradition that most guys do that. We have the midday.
So I asked Pods, yes? By the way, about showering one time after a doubleheader. What did he say? On TV. I was just like, so how many showers do you end up with in a day? Like, what are you doing there? Do you have to, like, what if it's just the traditional 30-minute doubleheader? Do you shower in the middle? Like, what happens? And his answer was typical Pods. He's like, well, it depends on the day. I'm like, ugh. I knew I couldn't get a straight answer out of you on that, Pods.
They do. Like the it's like a reset thing. It's like they punctuate sort of their work day with the number of times that they shower. It's, you know, one of those baseball things. In the upcoming Midday Midway, I have, and I don't know how they did it, but they made a lightsaber. And not like a toy, like an actual lightsaber. And we need Jay Zawoski to represent the I'm Fat podcast to weigh in, because McDonald's customers are deeply divided over a new menu item that some find disgusting and are saying not worth it.
So my story is this. Somehow a woman misplaced two babies while she was pregnant.
Misplaced them?
Didn't account for them? I don't know.
Oh, a human woman?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We'll get to that next on the Midday Midway on The Score.
This is Ian Happ, your center fielder from the north side. Connect Roasters and I are happy to announce the Home Run Club, a coffee subscription for baseball fans. You'll get freshly roasted coffee shipped to your door on the first of every month, access to exclusive game-used merch, personal notes from me, and most importantly, when I hit a home run, you'll get $5 towards coffee and merch on connectroasters.com. Our goal is to have 1,000 members enjoying great coffee and giving back to the community. For more information, go to connectroasters.com or homerunclub.coffee. Together, we can make a difference, one cup at a time.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five,
six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
Nine, ten.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and Rahimi. Middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
We're at the Midday Midway of this Wednesday show, so it's the Midday Midway on a hump day, which means we are halfway through our work week at this point, and it's all downhill from here. We talk baseball and just sort of the vagaries and vicissitudes and variants of baseball, leading the Cubs to sweep a doubleheader against the Dodgers with the two ace pitchers on the mound, the dominance of Dylan Cease being a thing. We heard Andrew Chafin mic'd up. We talked to Mike Florio. And digested the day in sports on the Cinco de Mayo, where I think I've talked myself into having carnitas tonight. Okay, I'm going to start with this, just so we can get this out of the way. Jay, open a mic. This from Yahoo News. The McDonald's chicken cheeseburger has fast food fans in a frenzy. Available at the locations in Singapore. The hotly debated McDonald's sandwich joins a long line of viral fast food items. So you ask, what is the chicken cheeseburger? It's a crispy chicken patty, lettuce, sweet tomato chili jam, and a patty made of fried mozzarella cheese. And there's a slice of cheese. It's like basically a mozzarella cheese stick. That is in the shape of a patty is what it looks like. So it's a breaded mozzarella patty on top of the chicken patty, and there's a slice of cheese in between them.
Are you honestly asking me if I would eat this? Because I'm buying an airline ticket to Singapore right now.
Really? Okay. Yes. I'm asking your thoughts. People don't like this idea.
I hate hot lettuce, so hold the lettuce. But yeah, the rest of it I'm totally in on. That sounds awesome.
Okay.
What's bad about that?
Just sweet tomato chili jam is basically like a spicy ketchup.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Usually, wouldn't it be like a grilled piece of chicken and not fried if you were to do the whole fried mozzarella thing on top?
No. Two frieds is better than one.
But like a caprese, you know how they have sometimes fried mozzarella with the caprese and the grilled piece of chicken?
Layla, you are so not fat.
Depends on the day.
That's an insult, by the way, I think.
No, you don't have grilled chicken? That's for salads.
You don't win friends with salads.
That's right. You don't. No, honestly, though, okay. It sounds a little ridiculous, which is the point of these things, but I've been a big fan of the chicken patty wheel, or the mozzarella stick wheel that Bennigan's used to have. Remember Bennigan's? They used to have that on a burger, and it was insane.
Do you remember the time Terry and I had a remote at Bennigan's and on South Michigan Avenue, and there were two within like a quarter mile of each other, and they on the promotions sheet they gave us the wrong Bennigan's. So like we showed up to do a show, and the manager is like, "What are you talking about?" And they're like, "So they started calling around, and we had to race to the other Bennigan's to do the show."
And Andy Garcia was there waiting for you.
I bet.
There at Chipotle.
I thought you meant Andy Garcia, the actor. Clearly, that is
incorrect. Sorry, that was a old reference. Andy worked at The Score like 15 years ago. Everyone listening should know that. Come on.
This just sounds troublesome. A woman from Mali thought she was pregnant with seven kids. Nope, nine.
What?
I just missed two. Yeah. She's 25, and I find it all very fascinating because that seems like one baby seems like a lot of work. I think that this sounds like way more work.
Nine?
Her name is Halima Sis. She had 5 girls and 4 boys, and they're all doing fine after a C-section was successfully carried out in Morocco. But yes, she was flown to Morocco in March to make sure the babies were delivered safely after the pregnancy. It attracted the attention of Mali's leaders. They wanted her to be okay, so they sent her there. They don't know if it was in vitro or not as to why she had so many births and how far along she was in her pregnancy. But yes, apparently both doctors in Morocco and in Mali missed 2 of the kids. So I guess she thought she was done after 7. Not quite. 2 more happened, and this all sounds pretty crazy.
Oh my God. And what if they like all go to expensive colleges? Like what could you possibly do? How could you send them, how could you clothe them and feed them all and then send them off to university? There's not a chance.
It's very rare that septuplets are carried to term, and the fact that non-tuplets, which is 9, happened is a definite feat of accomplishment.
You have to hire like a team of people just to help raise them. It's just one kid is a absolute life-wrecking pain in the ass. I can't imagine what, I mean, you don't sleep. I mean, I'm saying with one kid, it takes all your attention and all your energy. I don't know. I can't even get my head around it.
Somebody on Twitch asked if she was going to get a reality show. I don't know. Do you think they would do that in Mali or Morocco? It seems like something that could happen.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
But everybody's fine, apparently, or everybody's doing well. So that's the great part. But yeah, just, you know, miss 2 kids. And then there's that story of the woman on the plane who gave birth who didn't know she was pregnant. I have no idea how this stuff happens, but all of that gave me pause this week.
What it do, baby?
Yeah. Ever since Star Wars premiered in 1977, kids and adults alike wanted to get their hands on a lightsaber. The elegant weapon for a more civilized age is one of the most famous props in movie history and pop culture. And now, according to CNN Business, Disney has apparently created a real one. Yesterday, for Star Wars Day, they posted a 13-second clip of a Disney performer dressed as Star Wars hero Rey turning on a lightsaber with a solid, retractable blade of light extending from the hilt. It is not a visual effect. It is not a camera trick. It's as real as a lightsaber can get in this galaxy.
How?
The company's Imagineers, designers of their parks, rides, gadgets, and hotels, created the device to function like a real lightsaber and that the blade of light extends from the base of the sword. It's not for sale, not just yet. They say it is not, however, capable of cutting off a hand. It's not dangerous, but it is indeed a solid, opaque beam of light that extends at I don't know how they can stop it at a distance the way that they do, but they do. I've watched it, and they've done it, and until I see it with my own actual eyes, I don't know if I can believe it, but it's pretty convincing.
Does it make the sound, though?
Well, I can make the sound, too. But my guess is no, but...
So you have this lightsaber, and you can't make the sound? That's defeating the point of the lightsaber. Lights anywhere. Lights outside. We don't need light. We need the sound.
I've never seen a Star Wars movie.
That's not the sound, either.
No,
y'all know the sound.
The midway. Next up, we're going to talk baseball with our regular baseball expert, former ball player Cody Decker is up next. You're going to want to tune into Twitch, too, because he's a hoot when you can see him as well. So it's going to be fun. Keep it here. You got the score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!